You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jason and Jamie. This is episode 328, and I know we've not been very consistent about getting these episodes out the last 6 weeks or so. I think the last episode we recorded, or I mean published, was back on April 16th. So it's been a good 6 weeks. Our apologies for you listeners that we haven't gotten anything else out. Jason and I have just been really busy over the last month or so. And of course, as we go into summer, we kind of tend to be a little less consistent in the summer months as well, just with everything going on and all that. But with all that said, we do want to keep putting out episodes and keep sharing God's good word. And so we're going to do that when we can and how we can. And in this particular case, Jason is not with me in the recording studio here today. So it's just me in this episode. But I wanted to respond to, it's a topic we've covered before, but a question that was asked here this last week was in relationship to sex and marriage. And we, like I said, we've addressed the topic of sex and marriage and all that stuff multiple times in multiple episodes. So you can always go back and listen to archived episodes on our podcast, faithunpacked.com, or on social media as well, and be able to listen to all those past episodes on that topic. If you go to our website directly, you can actually search topic terms and find it more readily that way there. But the question specifically that was asked of me this week was from a couple that, you know, grew up in the purity culture of the 90s, and they have always kind of felt some shame as it relates, you know, to sex, even in their marriage relationship. And so just kind of asking, the nature of their question was, how do you overcome that? How do you overcome, in the context of marriage, feeling shameful or feeling bad about sex in a marriage relationship? And I think the best way to answer that question really is to say that we want to reframe our thinking in a good and biblical way. Because we recognize that there's been a lot of bad teaching on this particular topic, both from the world and even from the church. So the typical position of the world has been in American culture that, you know, sex is great, it's awesome, it's a biological act, and just do it with whomever or however or in whatever format you want, whatever your desires are, fulfill them. You know, it's a very hedonistic approach to this particular topic. And I would argue one that's been very devastating for the culture, very devastating for the family, very devastating for a lot of things. Society really has, you know, been impacted, not in a good way, by this kind of thinking. And at the same time, you know, largely the teaching of the church, especially during the purity culture years of the church, was to say that sex is gross and dirty and bad, so save it for marriage, save it for the one you love. And again, you know, neither of these perspectives represents what is a good biblical understanding of sex and sexuality. And so we want to begin there, because we got to recognize, you know, that the wisdom of man in all of its forms, whether it be in the church or outside the church, the wisdom of man is terrible. You know, the Proverbs tells us in Proverbs 14:12 and 16:25 says, "There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death." That is to say that the wisdom of man always leads to destruction. The wisdom of man always destroys everything it touches. You know, everything we think is so smart and so wise and so good in our own understanding always ends up just being really bad and really destructive. And you certainly see that played out with either of these views that have been commonly pushed, whether in the world or in the church. And so what we got to do, what we want to do, is yield to the good wisdom of God. Again, you know, Proverbs 9:10, for example, says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." That is to say, if you want to be wise, then we have to fear the Lord. If we want to understand God's good, then we have to embrace the good wisdom of God. And the fear of the Lord, from a biblical perspective, is not just a reverential awe of God, but it's a practical taking and applying the good truths of God to our lives as well. And so not only do we embrace God's good wisdom or recognize God as the source of wisdom, but we actively apply it to our lives as well. And certainly that plays out in terms of sexuality. And so to understand, you know, what is God's good design for sex, I think we have to start with what is God's good picture or God's good purpose for sex, because that's where we have to begin. You know, the biblical word for sexual sin, just the, you know, in the generic sense, is a word called porneia. Like Ephesians 5:3-5, right? "But sexual immorality and impurity and greed should not even be heard of among you, as is proper for the saints. You know, coarse and foolish talk or crude joking are not suitable, but rather give thanks for now and recognize this. Every sexually immoral person or impure or greedy person who is an idolater does not have an inheritance in the kingdom of the Messiah and of God." That's Ephesians 5:3-5. Or 1 Timothy 1:10, "For sexual immorality and homosexuality, for kidnappers, liars, perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to sound teaching." So speaking of that sexual immorality, 1 Corinthians 6:9, right? "Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. No sexually immoral people, no idolaters or adulterers or anyone practicing homosexuality." And so you see this repeated phrase, right? Sexual immorality. Well, The Greek word is porneia, and porneia is a word, I say, the way I think of it, is it's a Greek word that's a definition in reversion, meaning the word porneia is everything that is not God's design, right? Everything that is outside of God's good design, which then invites the question, well, what is God's good design? And the Bible spells that out pretty well for us as well. We see God's very good purpose in sexuality. And I think we can summarize, you know, the biblical view of sexuality in this way by saying God has given sex to us as a means of showing his glory, delighting in worship, and fulfilling his design for procreation, intimacy, physical pleasure under the covenant of marriage between a husband and a wife. I think that's a great summary of God's good purpose. And it starts really with God's original design. You have to go back to Genesis 1, 26-28, right? It says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. They will rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock, all the earth, and the creatures that crawl on the earth." So God created man in his own image. He created him in the image of God. He created them male and female. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it." And then in Genesis 2:24, we see this is why a man will leave his father and mother and be bound with his wife, and they will become one flesh. Both man and his wife were naked, yet they felt no shame. And so we're given right from the start, you know, a good picture of God's good design for humanity. And that design for humanity is that, first of all, men and women are made in the image of God and are made for this thing that the Bible calls oneness. And what is this oneness that the two come together and create? And for that, again, you have to look back to the design, right? If we're made in the image of God, then we have to ask the question, how is God? And God is perfect in unity, in community, in the persons of himself, right? In terms of biblical doctrine, we understand or we believe in one God who is eternally existing in three persons of one God, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. These are three persons of one God, and they are, while they are all one God, they have different roles in relationship to the Godhead itself, you know, Father, Son, and Spirit. And so what is drawn out in that beautiful picture, and, you know, again, we've spent some time on this in terms of Trinitarian doctrine in other episodes, so I'm not going to go very deep into it here just because we don't really have a lot of time. But what we understand or come to understand about this Trinitarian nature of God is a God who is perfect in unity, perfect in community, perfect in fellowship, perfect in relationship, perfect in love, right? God has one will, one mind, one heart, one purpose. And so God is, by his own very nature, fully complete. God lacks nothing relationally. God lacks nothing ontologically of his nature itself. God lacks absolutely nothing in any of these forms at all. And so we're made in the image of God, which means that we're made to be like in relationship like God. Not to say we are God or we become God. That's not what I'm saying at all. So definitely don't hear me saying that. But we are made for relationship like God. Which means perfect unity, perfect community, perfect fellowship, perfect love, right? So when we see this command that that a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife and the two become one, that's the picture we're meant to understand. That in this oneness, in a biblical sense, there is perfect unity, there's perfect community, there's perfect fellowship, there's perfect love. And so it really is a picture that's way more than just sexual union, right? Or sexual function. It's something much more profound than that. It's something much more beautiful than that, to a good degree. And the Apostle Paul, you know, kind of gives us a greater understanding of this when he talks about marriage itself in the book of Ephesians chapter 5. He gives us, you know, the beautiful picture of or that God draws out of a marriage that's actually meant to be worship, that it's actually meant to showcase the relationship between us and Christ. Right. And in Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 25, it says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her with the washing of water by the word. He did this to present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or anything like that, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands are to love their wives as their own body, for he who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hates his own flesh, but provides and cares for it just as Christ does for the church. Since we are members of his body, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This mystery is profound, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. To sum up, each one of you is to love his wife as himself, and a wife is to respect her husband. And so Paul's pointing out that, hey, I'm talking about marriage, but I'm actually not talking about marriage. I'm talking about the thing that marriage is meant to point to, which is the beautiful union between Christ and his church, right? There's going to come a day when the entire church is in the presence of the Lord. You know, the Bible calls this the marriage supper of the Lamb, when God is with his people, and it's so beautiful. We see a picture of that in Revelation 21, verses 1 through 5. It says, "Then I saw a new heavens and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea no longer existed. I also saw a holy city, a new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. Then I heard a loud voice from the throne, 'Look, God's dwelling is with humanity, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will no longer exist. Grief and crying and pain will exist no longer, because the previous things have passed away.' And then the one seated on the throne said, 'Look, I am making everything new.'" And so the whole picture, the whole beautiful picture of marriage is meant to draw us to that very moment, right? When there's this beautiful union between Christ, the head of the church, the groom, and the bride, the church proper. And it's such a gorgeous thing. And that is to say that every bit of human marriage is meant to showcase the glory of God. Every bit of human marriage is meant to showcase the union between Christ and his church. And even sex itself is, in the context of marriage, an act of worship as it draws to that oneness that will one day be true of the bride of Christ and her groom, the Lord Jesus Christ. And so when you think about it that way, it stops sounding gross, right? It stops sounding like nasty. It's actually something really beautiful, in a sense. It's actually something that is delightful and good. And I believe, in the context of good marriage, which is loving and serving and giving and sharing, in that context, I think you're meant to delight as a husband and as a wife to the degree that you're like, man, if this union is so good, if this union is so good and delightful and fun, what must the glory of God be like, right? What must that beautiful union in the presence and glory of God? And we know that the glory of God is just way too intense, even for human minds to handle, even for physical human bodies to handle. Because you see in Exodus where Moses is like, God, I want to see all of your glory. And God's response to him is, you could not handle it. And so he gets to see just a little glimpse of the glory of God. And even that little glimpse is just too much, right? Even that little glimpse was more than Moses could really handle. And that's the glory of God we have to look forward to. And so in a biblical context, sex is a beautiful thing. Sex is a delightful thing. Sex has great and glorious purposes of worship, right? That it does that. It showcases that picture. But sex also has, you know, pragmatic and practical purposes. You saw that in the command in Genesis, right? Where the man and woman come together in marriage, and God's encouragement to them is to be fruitful and to multiply, you know? So the act of sex is not just for the purpose of worship. It's also for the purpose of procreation, that it's not just to delight and enjoy and engage in relational connection and spiritual connection and physical connection. And while all of that is good and beautiful and definitely part of God's good purpose, it also has the practical purpose as well, which is for the purpose of procreation, you know, creating life and new life and continuing God's good replication of humans made in the image of God in the world. And that's a good and beautiful thing as well. In fact, in Proverbs, it says that, you know, children are a blessing from the Lord, and the man who has a quiver full of them experiences that blessing from the Lord. And so there's that good purpose as well. And then the other practical purpose as well is to safeguard or to protect against sexual immorality, against sin, you know, that sin nature, that desire of the flesh that wants to engage in ungodly ways, of which, you know, there's a lot. I mean, the Bible speaks to pornography, 1 Corinthians 6:9. It speaks to sex outside of marriage, 1 Timothy 1:10. It speaks to homosexuality or same gender sexuality. Romans 1, 26 through 27, Leviticus 18, 22 or 20, 13, or even in the text we just read there, 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:10. Jesus talks about lust, Matthew 5:27-28. You know, Ephesians talks about sexual joking or sexual talking, sexual texting. Ephesians 5:4, sexual joking, you know, all of these things are outside of God's good picture. Why? Because all of them are opposite that beautiful union and communion and worship that is the good biblical picture, right? I mean, godly sex is between one man and one woman in the context of marriage. Sinful sex is sex with anybody and results in results in no actual intimacy or special connection, no oneness, no special relationship. Godly sex is relationship building. It leads to great connection. Sinful sex is self-serving. It's all about the self and the service of self. Godly sex gives up one's own right in the service of another. Sinful sex reinforces self-rights or selfishness. Godly sex is about pleasing the other, your spouse. Sinful sex is about pleasing only yourself. Godly sex requires love and service. Sinful sex is loveless and effortless. Godly sex leads to satisfaction and strengthening of marital bonds. Sinful sex leads to addiction, actually. Godly sex showcases God's love for his church. Sinful sex showcases self-gratification. Godly sex glorifies God. Sinful sex degrades the self and the temple of the Holy Spirit, the human body. And so you see just the dramatic difference in these purposes between God's good design and just the distorted or worldly or fleshly picture of that. But the Bible invites and encourages a married couple to engage and to delight and enjoy, right? Go to Proverbs chapter 5. It says in verse 15, drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone, not for strangers. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth as a loving hind and a graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy you always and at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. His own iniquity will capture the wicked, and he will be held to the cords of his sin. He will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray. And so the encouragement is to recognize, like, hey, inside God's good purpose, it's awesome. It's delightful. Yes, enjoy it. Embrace it. And here's the thing. It is not biblical sin to desire sex. That is not unbiblical. God designed it. God created it. God is the author of the idea. In fact, you don't find... I heard somebody say one time in relationship to Adam and Eve that, you know, it's not like God created Adam and Eve and went to make himself a sandwich and then came back and was shocked to realize, like, what are they doing? It's like, no, this was God's good design. In the context of marriage, it's a good thing, and it's a beautiful thing, and it's a blessed thing, and it's a worshipful thing, and it's meant to be a joyful and a joyous and a delightful thing. All of that is biblically true. And in fact, the Bible even encourages a husband and wife to regularly and actively engage. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7. It says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because sexual immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. A husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also a wife to her own husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come again together, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." And it's a beautiful thing. And in fact, you know, Paul goes on to say to the single person, he says, "But I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them to remain even as I am. But if you do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion." And so it's just, you know, pragmatic recognition. Hey, God created the body. God created the desire. God created sex. God created all these things. And in the context of marriage, it's a good and delightful thing, and it should be engaged in on a regular basis. And that's a good and healthy and enjoyable and delightful thing, and it's good. And so my encouragement to, let's say, the married couple out there that maybe wrestles with this, you know, that sense of shame, even in marriage, because they've grown up with the thinking or the perspective that, you know, sex is somehow bad or shameful or dirty or gross or, you know, any of those things, it's actually to recognize God's good purpose. You know, what was God's good design, and actually get to delight and enjoy the good design of God in this area of marriage. That, friends, is not a bad thing. Of course, we're speaking, again, just to clarify, only in relationship to marriage, in God's good purpose, not in any other form or any other use of sex or sexuality. One man, one woman, in the context of marriage, it's meant to be good. It's meant to be delightful. It's meant to be worship. It's meant to be the culmination of that emotional connection and relational connection and that oneness overall that ends up in a large degree culminating in that physical connection as well. And what a good and beautiful thing that is. So to the married husband or wife out there, if you feel shame about this aspect of life or marriage, you don't have to. You don't need to. Embrace the good and delightful good purposes of God, and enjoy as God would have you do for the purpose of God's glory, looking forward to, right, the aspect that if this is so good, if sex is so good, if the oneness in marriage is so good, what must the glory of God be like?
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.